Well, good morning. My name's Doug, if you're visiting here, and it's brilliant to have you here. Let me just get this sorted here. Yeah, if you're new or you're visiting, it's just brilliant that you're joining us today. I have the privilege of leading the church here, and for the next 4 weeks, I hope you'll stick around and join us as we look at some difficult questions together. And that you come, this is obviously one that a lot of people have asked and continue to ask, but I think over the next few weeks as well, we're going to be diving into some stuff that will be hopefully very helpful for all of us. These are big things, and I don't want to pretend that in one session like this, I'm going to clear up everything, and you know, you'll walk away thinking, okay, well, I don't battle with that anymore. I still battle with it. I haven't spent I don't know how many hours preparing this. I have a whole new set of questions now, which I'm going to have to do a different series on. hopefully we can reduce the size of the question mark in your mind, and particularly if you battle with belief in a Christian God, particularly around this, it's almost like a stumbling block to considering a God who could be like that. My hope and prayer is that today I would be able to help you make some progress seeing God I think more clearly as I see him and as the scriptures portray him. What we want to do this morning, I'm going to try by God's grace not to talk for too long, which if you're a regular, you'll know you should just start praying already now for that to happen. But at the end, what we want to have is a Q&A thing. I realize that I may not answer everyone's questions, and so we want to answer questions that you actually have. So this is Quent's number. It's not mine. I'm not going to be fielding this on the go, yeah? So this is Quent's number. If during the message a question pops up into your head, whatever, bomb him an SMS. Keep it succinct, your question, and then we'll have a bit of time after the preach to go through as many of those as we can. And we'll be very honest if we can't answer the questions. I'm not going to pretend and just like talk in circles here. So this is our new series called Stumped. Thanks to Mark for that name. Hopefully we won't all walk out of here feeling still like that. But as we start, let me say this, that in multiple surveys that churches have done, Christians have done, even unbelieving agencies have done, the number one barrier to belief in the Christian God is the difficulty that people have that how could a good God allow evil and suffering? This is consistently the number one issue that people have, reconciling what sort of either their picture of God is or the God that they're told he is like this with what they see with their eyes around them, because it's easy to see why this is the number one question. It's not hard to see evil and suffering. You just look around the world. And I mean, there's different levels of suffering. So there's global suffering. You could start with that. You could look at a macro kind of thing, like something like the tsunami happens in Thailand, Indonesia, that area. And there's multiple tens and hundreds of thousands who are killed and affected. And the whole world is asking the same question at the same time and feeling that suffering collectively. You can distill it a bit smaller, like sort of communities go through suffering together. There's been a lot of these sort of school shootings that happening in the States over the last couple of years. You know, you see these communities rallying around. There's a gunman goes into a little prep school there and mows down 15 kids there in their classrooms, and a community rallies around, and there's community pain because everyone knows everyone else, and there's a grief that's almost particular to them, and the world watches that. But probably the one that we're most familiar with is our own individual suffering and pain. I don't know, and I don't pretend to know all of you or where you are, but everyone has their own story and suffers differently. Everyone, if you haven't suffered yet, I'll make a bold claim here that you will. We won't all suffer in the same way and to the same degree, but there's only a few things that you can be guaranteed of in life, and one of them is suffering. And I'll explain later why I think it's part of God's design and his ultimate plan for us. But if you're not suffering at the moment, you either have or you will. And so this is a timeless thing for us. And when it comes close, that's when things start to really get the rub. You know, when we're thinking, we're asking these questions in a conceptual level about the tsunami and stuff, and it's an intellectual exercise, that's one thing. But when you're in the midst of suffering, or it comes really close to home, you ask those questions very differently. And I'll be honest with you that my bent this morning is to answer that on a more of a personal level. You know, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an academic. I'm not an intellectual, whatever. I'm a pastor. I love people. I love you guys. And my prayer is to be able to help you make sense of the suffering that you're going through. I'm not going to be able to answer all your philosophical questions. And there's a lot of good books that you can read from people much smarter than me who can help you answer some of those questions, because ultimately I don't think you can answer all of these. But my prayer is to be able to move people who are struggling or who have struggled. Some of you I know sitting here still feeling the repercussions and in the midst of great suffering. And it's to that I want to try and bend things rather than move it past an intellectual exercise. You just can't deny the reality of evil and suffering. And because of that, it's a question that every culture and every belief system has to answer. It's not just a Christian problem, like how can a good God allow evil and suffering? Every system of belief and every culture needs to answer this question. Where does suffering come from? Where does evil come from? Who's in control of all of this mess? And what's going on? And what kind of a God would allow this kind of stuff? And every belief system has tried to answer this in different ways. Now, let's look at a couple of them before we get down to the Christian worldview. If you grew up as a Muslim, Islam teaches that Allah allows suffering and that your response is just to be subordinate. Islam doesn't allow any shaking your fist at the heavens kind of thing. It's subjection. Allah knows he's wise and merciful, and he knows what's going on, and you don't question him. You just suck it up and go through it. And I think that is obviously at the other end of the Christian gospel. What about Hinduism? Well, Hindus believe in karma, which is a very depressing system of belief, if you want. That you can't make any sense of the suffering that you're going through now, but it's the result because you, in your previous life, you weren't a good person. You kicked the dog, you yelled at your kids, whatever, and now, you know, this is what's happening to you. It's visited back on you because of something. You don't know what it is necessarily, but either you did something bad or somebody else did something bad in your circle, and now you're paying for it. And that's this endless cycle of just karma going on. Again, I don't think the gospel knows anything of that. Buddhists see all of life as suffering. They feel like it's just this thing, and suffering is caused by desire. And the whole aim and focus of Buddhism is to eliminate desire, because desire gives root to all of these evils. So they try and become nothing. That's the whole goal of Buddhism, to reach a state of nothingness and therefore eliminate desire and suffering. And you never really know if you're making any progress along that route. What about the atheists? You might be wondering, if you are an atheist, why I put atheists in this system of belief thing, because I believe that atheism is a belief. It's just as much of a belief as Christianity or other beliefs. It's just the belief in unbelief. And one of the main proponents of atheism, Richard Dawkins, in his book River Out of Eden, which I would recommend that you read out of interest, perhaps. I don't think it has very many, a lot of help, but especially if you're a Christian, it's a very good book to read. He says this: the universe is made up of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication. Some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. I mean, talk about a hope-filled worldview. I don't understand how people can hold to that with such vigor, that we live in pitiless indifference, that just, you're going to get lucky, not going to get lucky. There is just no hope in that at all. What about the New Age worldview? Some of you may have dabbled or read the book The Secret, which has really been popularized by Oprah. Listen to a quote out of The Secret. It teaches this law of attraction stuff. It says, nothing merely shows up in your experience. You attract it, all of it, no exceptions. We must still explain that only you could have caused it, for no one else has the power to attract what comes to you but you. By focusing upon this unwanted thing or the essence of it, you have created it by default. Do you know how many people have read that and would hold that as gospel? You know what it's actually saying there? That you have thought this thing up and you have brought it upon yourself. And they quizzed the guys who are an adherent of this. It was Larry King. Quizzed one of these guys and said, look man, there was this girl, young girl who was raped. You know? Did she visit this upon herself? No exceptions. There's no exceptions. You think these things up and you, this law of attraction, you bring it into your own life. I mean, it's an awful answer in my mind. I am 100% persuaded, and you'll hear that very strongly this morning, that the Christian worldview provides the most compelling, the most compassionate, and the most hopeful answer to the question of suffering. But before we dive into exactly what that worldview is, just a couple of comments I want to make around that question. How can a good God allow evil and suffering? The first is that I think it's okay for us to acknowledge that evil points more to the existence of God than away from it. Evil points to the existence of God. It's more of an argument that God exists than he doesn't. If I was to say to you, I'm just having a look around to see the average age of kids here. I don't want to scar any people here. But one of the things that it's a scourge that just gets us inside as South Africans is whenever you hear of babies being raped in the country. I mean, every time you hear it, it's just like, I feel nauseous. It's something in me, a holy rage kicks in. And you would battle to find many people who would think, that's a great idea. You know, it's just an opinion, you know, dag, you getting all uptight about this thing. There's tons of people who think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, there's this inbuilt universal moral law that we feel together as humanity, and a collective outrage. Now, where does that come from? Where does that come from? Many of you will be familiar with a guy called C.S. Lewis. And I would advocate that you read everything that he's ever written. Except some of those Narnia books. Don't start with that stuff. Start with the proper books. I don't know. He was an avowed atheist who set out to prove the non-existence of God kind of thing and ended up coming to faith in Christ as a result of it. But he set out, very bright guy, to prove the non-existence of God. And God, you know, got a hold of him. To read his conversion story is just enthralling. It's brilliant. And he says this, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying that it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it didn't happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. Lewis arguing that, and he goes on and he builds the case brilliantly. He says, look, that outrage that we feel, that sense of justice and unjustness, it points to a universal moral law. And you have to then take the next step to say, where on earth does that universal moral law come from? There must behind that be a universal moral law giver. And he is a self-identified universal moral law giver in the Christian worldview, and that's God. It's the God of the Bible. I would argue that suffering also points more to the existence of God than away. When you suffer, do you feel like it's a normal thing? It's like, yeah, this is cool, you know? You don't. There's something unnatural about it. You weren't created to suffer. It's not supposed to go like this. It's not supposed. There's something that reacts in you whenever anyone suffers. It jars with us. It's unnatural. You know why it's unnatural? Because we weren't created for it. And at the end, it'll be eradicated. And we're in this in-between phase where God in his mystery and in the sovereignty is allowing suffering and evil for multiple purposes, but we find it unnatural. It's not built into us. They are intruders into the world. And the Christian worldview and narrative points to a good God who created things perfectly and who will restore everything perfectly at the end. So, on the one hand, you have evil and suffering, put them in the same thing there, according to this question. I think as I said, that evil and suffering can exist with God. They don't necessarily need to be divorced from the concept of God. So let's say now we're happy to allow evil and suffering to coexist with an existence of God. Your next thing question is, well, what kind of a God allows that to happen? You know, you can't deny evil and suffering. Yes, God is also in the mix. What kind of a God then is in control of all of this? And people have tried to answer this in a lot of different ways. There's the, I'll just call them simple names, the bad God theory. Bad God theory. That God can do something about it, but he doesn't. He chooses, out of a decision of his will, not to do anything about it. He's happy with looking at the world and thinking, it's rad, because he's innately bad. He's a bad God. And maybe some of you think that, that God is bad. And I think it's a difficult view to hold on to, because you then have a whole bunch of other questions that come up that are much harder to answer. Where does all the good in the world come from? If God, the one who's over everything, is essentially bad, how do you explain the prevalence of good everywhere? Is God just like, you know, he's bad, but good is fighting back against him, and he's actually not winning there? There seems to be just so much good. And, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons. I'll just give you one more. You have to explain the coming into the world of Jesus Christ, who self-identified as that God, that bad God who people would describe him, and lay down his life for those who he had made. It's a very, very difficult thesis to hold to of the bad God. But others say this, the weak God theory, that God would really love to do something about it, but he can't. He's sort of got his hands behind his back. He just, his heart breaks. He feels bad, but he can't do anything about it. He's limited. He's limited by either Satan, you know, the devil. He's got God in the corner. There's a battle and God's not winning. Or he's limited by us. You know, God's given us free will. And so he's just, you know, sorry, God, that was a bad decision, you know, give humans free will, because now they're just using it against you, and look at all the chaos that's happening. Some people advocate that God is limited by the systems that he's put in place, that God created the world, wound it up, and he stepped back, and he's just sort of letting it wind down until it's all done. It's called the watchmaker theory, and it's just, it doesn't hold any water when you look at the way the world is. Some people, erroneously, maybe you're a Christian, you've been exposed to this, that that God is limited by our lack of faith. You know? You're suffering because you lack faith. If you just beef up the faith, you won't suffer anymore. What a load of crap is that? That's not in the Bible. You won't find that verse anywhere there. But that's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. Because what it does is that it puts Christians in a spiral to say, well, it's all on me. How do I wind up my faith? Ooh, you know? God is hamstrung until I get my act together and I find some faith from somewhere. It's awful. I mean, it's not difficult to know what I think of that. So, I would suggest to you that the Christian worldview advocates a God who's sovereign and involved, that evil and suffering are real, and that our natural question, and the one that we primarily need to answer, is why do we suffer? Why do we suffer? Which is a difficult question to answer. I think the Christian worldview helps us in the following three ways. Firstly, it explains evil and suffering. Christian worldview explains evil and suffering, and it's got a word for it called sin. That's how the Christian worldview explains evil and suffering. Sin. God created the world without sin. Sin entered the world. And since then, the world itself is fallen. We live in a fallen creation. In Romans chapter 8, verse 20, the author of Romans, Paul, says that creation is groaning in frustration. Things are not as they should be. You know, you see earthquakes and tsunamis and all this stuff, and you just think, something's broken. The actual world is broken. There's a lot of beauty in it, but it's not the way it's supposed to be. We live in a fallen world. And so we will suffer as a result of just being on a planet that is being marked by sin. And then it won't always be that way. One day it'll be restored. But for now, that's how it is. So there's a fallen world. You can suffer as a result of that. You can suffer as a result of others sinning against you. This is one that I'm particularly sensitive to. Many people who sit in churches suffer. Many people who don't sit in churches used to sit in a church, and they don't want to go to church anymore, because they were part of that church and somebody hurt them. Something went wrong, God wasn't there, the church didn't care, and they walked away. And I understand that. I understand that. And my heart breaks for people like that. But the reality of it, the reality of life is that people will sin against you. Some of it will be small and inconsequential, and some of it will be huge. As a pastor, sometimes I just get to see the raw end of this. I get to see adultery. I get to see such mess in people's lives. And I wouldn't say I love it. I don't love the mess. I love seeing what God can do in the midst of mess. But man, the capacity people have to sin against each other, the capacity that human beings have to sin against each other, the way humans can torture each other, where on earth did that come from? Where did we teach humans to do that? You can't argue that human beings are intrinsically good. It's a very difficult point to prove. Just have a look at some of the people that humanity has produced. Look at yourself. You're not as fantastic and good as you think you are. But it's okay. There's good news for people who aren't all they're cracked up to be. You can suffer because people sin against you. You can suffer, thirdly, because of your own sin. You do stupid things. You do foolish things. You do sinful things. Outright disobedience and rebellion against God. God has put moral laws in place. He's given commands that are not suggestions to be weighed up. They're the commands to be obeyed. And when we disobey them, we shouldn't wonder why we hurt ourselves. You know, you can do, and it's not just in a moral kind of a sense. If I go and drink copious amounts of alcohol and become an alcoholic and my whole body shuts down and stuff. You know, I shouldn't shake my fist at God and say, how can you allow this to happen to me? Then, well, you know, I sort of said, like, stay away from getting a bit too excited with the booze there, bud. Like, now you're blaming me for your own sin. You know, God's put stuff in place that if we violate those things, that's just what will happen. We will suffer as a result of our own sinfulness. So the Christian worldview proposes, the narrative suggests, that sin is the source of all of our suffering. And I want to say something here that's very important. That God is not the source of all of our suffering. He is, in an ultimate sense, behind it. And I think we'll cover this maybe in the Q&A. Somebody's going to ask this. Is God ultimately behind evil and suffering? The short answer is yes. The short answer is yes. But he's not responsible for any of it. You can't credit evil and suffering against God. It's all against sin. And yes, God does allow that. Secondly, in the Christian narrative, it shows that suffering is not meaningless. This is perhaps one of the most encouraging things. Suffering is not meaningless. Firstly, it draws us to Christ. Suffering is given to draw us to Christ. C.S. Lewis himself, who came to Christ, he started that journey of coming to Christ through the death of his wife. He said that suffering is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. You know, people are attentive to the existence of God or to the question of the existence of God when they're suffering, far more than when things are going swimmingly in their lives. Think of your own life. When you've suffered, you're suddenly aware to options. You know, when it's the same picture you see in the movies all the time, when the airplane's about to crash, everyone wants to join the prayer meeting. You know, you don't battle to get people to pray in an airplane that's hurtling towards the ground, you know? Ask them in the business lounge before you take off, got work to do, whatever. Ask them again when it's, you know, oh, sure, God, hold hands, kumbaya, carry on. There's something about it. And Spurgeon, he's a famous Baptist preacher. He described it as this. He spoke of suffering being a blessed hurricane that drives us to the rock of ages. A blessed hurricane. You feel like you're in a hurricane, absolutely, but it's a blessed hurricane. Thank you, God, for this hurricane that drove me to God. There's some people who wouldn't be Christians without suffering. I wouldn't be a Christian if my stepdad hadn't died when I was 16. After losing my dad when I was 7 and having a bit of a rough childhood, I wouldn't be a Christian. That instant of him dying triggered in me a searching and a questioning. And I'm a Christian because of immense suffering that I went through. It happens. the blessed hurricane. You see, suffering doesn't create a need for God. Suffering reveals your need for God. You live with a need for God, and suddenly, as you suffer, you see it more clearly. There's a wonderful old hymn. I would love to read the words out to you, but it'll take too long. And it's called, "He washed my eyes with tears that I might see him." He washed my eyes with tears that I might see him. Some of you, that's what's happening. He's washing your eyes with tears so that you can see him. You still have tears, but there is a point in it. There's a purpose in your suffering, and it's so that you can see him. It's not just so that you can be crushed and stagger around without any answer to why you're suffering. Secondly, suffering brings us to maturity. In both 1 Peter and in James, both of them talk about faith being, the genuineness of faith being tested through suffering. James says we should count it all joy when we suffer various kinds of trials because they're producing us perseverance and character. And that all must take its path until we mature and complete, lacking nothing. If you're a Christian and you're suffering, you should not ask why. You can ask why, but the answer's already there. God wants to make you mature. Now, if you don't want to suffer, don't become a Christian. If you're not a Christian yet, and you want to live a life that's going to involve no suffering, I would advocate for you not to choose Christianity. Choose something else. I'm not saying like Christianity is like the boot camp of all world faiths kind of thing, like we're the Marines, you know, we really suck it up kind of thing. But, you know, I think the Bible, Jesus says, in this world, you will have trouble. Bam, end of sentence. That's it. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart because I've overcome the world. There's something else that's in the midst of suffering that's greater than the fact that you actually will suffer. But I don't want to smoke and mirrors you, especially if you're not a Christian, and say, yeah, just become a Christian. It'll be cool. I promise you, it'll be rad. You can have your best life now. It's all going to go lekker. It may go pear-shaped in the most horrendous way. But he will be bringing you to maturity. And lastly, he allows it to bring about his purposes. Suffering and evil brings about the purposes of God. Some of you may not know the story of Joseph in Genesis. Joseph was one of 12 sons. Ended up getting sold into slavery, heading up to Egypt. Lots of suffering, lots of confusion, questions. What is going on? Looks like so much evil is going on. And yet God is sovereignly using what was going on there to preserve his people, to save them in an ultimate sense. You look at the most tragic act in history, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And you got to say this. I mean, Acts 14 argues this. It says, look, human beings, you're culpable. You're responsible because you're the ones who actually nailed him to the cross. But behind all of that, there was somebody else who was orchestrating things. In the midst of the greatest evil, God was behind it, bringing about his purposes. He could have intervened, but he didn't. And you look at it and you think on the reading of it, this is horrific. This man is being crucified. This God is being crucified. This should stop. This shouldn't be. And yet God is willing to let it go forward to accomplish his purposes. God will allow evil and suffering because there is a way in which they achieve his purposes. William Lane Craig says this, "We're not in a good position to assess with confidence the probability that God has no morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evils that occur. As finite persons, we're limited in space and time, in intelligence and insight. But the transcendent and sovereign God sees the end of history from its beginning and providentially orders history so that his purposes are ultimately achieved through human free decisions. In order to achieve his ends, God may well have to put up with certain evils along the way. Evils which appear pointless or unnecessary to us within our limited framework may be seen to have been justly permitted from within God's wider framework." Why does he allow it? Because he's God. And he knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. Third point under this is that the Christian narrative draws a line in the sand for suffering. Both answers the question of why sin. It provides an answer to why we suffer. There's purposes in it. And it draws an ultimate line in the sand and says, suffering no more. There will be a day when you will not suffer and evil will have no place in this world. And there's some Christians who live with a kind of other world mentality, like, oh, I just can't wait for heaven and stuff like that. There's others who are like, don't worry about heaven. You know, God's called us to be busy here, you know, get your head down and whatever now. But I think if you read the Bible, you see a people who lived in the light of the way one day, in the light of the way things were going to be one day. And that changes your current reality. If you're suffering now, you know that your suffering won't continue forever. If you're battling with evil now, you know that everything will be made right. God will not allow this to continue forever. One day, everything broken will be fixed. As Lewis says in one of his books, everything untrue will become true. There is a line in the sand for suffering. And if you're suffering now, part of my encouragement to you is to take a long-term view to what you're going through. Take a long-term view to it. There are people who, in God's wisdom and in His sovereign grace, allows people to suffer for the entire duration of their life and gives them grace in the midst of it. But you know what? One day, and I've heard some people speak about this, you can read multiple Christian biographies, people like Joni Erickson Tata, confined to a wheelchair since she was 17. She's saying one day she's going to be able to walk when she's in heaven with Jesus. She can't wait for it. And it fills her with great joy now that there is a future coming that will be free of evil and suffering. You need to take a long-term view to your life. Otherwise, suffering can crush you. As we close, let me say this. Let me answer this question. Where is God when you suffer? Where is God when you suffer? The simple answer to this is that He is near. That God is near. I believe that the Christian worldview, the Bible, makes it clear that God is a God who suffered so that He is familiar with our sufferings and that He doesn't look at the world and just feel nothing. That He feels compassion. He feels brokenness over the suffering that you and I go through. And He is intimately acquainted with it because He came to our world to suffer. And there's a greater purpose in that. That in the coming of Jesus, God comes into the world to suffer for a greater purpose so that one day we would never suffer. That we could be reconciled to God, firstly. That one day we wouldn't suffer. And that when we suffer in the context of a relationship of a good dad who is allowing it for reasons that we may not know but are good reasons and for our benefit. There can be no greater hope for a Christian than to know that God is with you when you're suffering. Some of you have heard the story or heard me talk about this before when we were living in Seattle, and I picked up that mystery illness that had me bedridden for a while, and the pain would intensify at night. In the middle of the night was when I'd be at my most sore. And I remember nights after night where the entire left side of my body, I wouldn't be able to move it. Wouldn't be able to feel anything, wouldn't be able to move it. And thought I was having a stroke because I've watched enough movies. I know that when that happens on the left side, you're having a stroke and you should say your goodbyes. And I would lie there just gripped with fear thinking, I don't want to die in Seattle. Well, I didn't want to die anywhere, but I didn't want to die over there and my time. And as that happened night after night, I remember just diving into the depths of despair. And there were many nights when I would just lie in my bed, just crying. Claire would be awake, the kids would be sleeping. You know, in the middle of the night when you suffer and it feels like everyone else is just peacefully asleep, you feel an acute loneliness and you feel the burden of your suffering so much more acutely. But something wonderful happened. The more I think about it, I mean, if I get emotional talking about this, it's because I remember it so vividly that in the midst of the middle of the night there, God would meet with me in a way that I've never met with Him before. There would be a tenderness and a realness to the presence of God in the midst of the night as I'm in tears, as I can't feel my body, I'm not knowing how long this is going to last for. And I knew that God loved me. I knew that God loved me. I didn't doubt it. I still had all the whys, but the only thing that would help me to go to sleep at night and not be racked by fear of what was going to happen that evening would be the fact that I knew when I felt like that, God would come close to me. I don't have all the answers for the why, because the ultimately, when you suffer, you don't need answers to your why. You need a who. You need a who. You need Jesus in the midst of your suffering. Because the whys, you'll never get to the bottom of all of those. There's a wonderful verse in Romans 8, verse 32. It says this, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" Graciously give us all things. I can make one promise to you that when you suffer, God is near. And that his promise to us is to give us grace to endure in the midst of it. Some of it only happens as you suffer. As you suffer, as that comes about, that's when the grace comes. It's not there before. And if you've suffered, maybe you know what I'm talking about. You don't feel spiritually strong, but as you enter into that suffering, God appears. That's because he promised to be like that. Maybe you know the story of Daniel and his friends. In the Old Testament book of Daniel, Daniel and his friends exiled to Babylon, and they're not really interested in worshiping the local deities and stuff, and they ended up getting thrown into the fire. If you grew up in Sunday school, maybe you remember this story. They get thrown into the fire. Not Daniel, but his three mates with complicated names. And as these guys are looking at the fire, how many people are in the fire? Four. And the guys who are watching say, "But there's another man in the fire. And he looks like a son of the gods." You see, the reality of it is that when you're in the midst of the fire, there is always another man in the fire. There is always another man in the fire. And it is God himself in the midst of the greatest fire and trial that you could possibly go through, because he's promised. He made a promise on himself, and he doesn't lie, that he will never leave you nor forsake you. He's in the midst of it. And you can trust in the sovereignty of God, in the goodness of God, and in the presence of God to come close to you. Let's pray quick, and then we'll just do some of these questions. Father, thank you that you're a God familiar with suffering, that you're a God who loves us, that you don't look indifferently on us, you don't look indifferently on our situations. We pray that you would help us this morning as we consider these things, to look to you, to consider the blessed hurricane that drives us to you, and that for those who are suffering this morning, in the midst of it, they would meet you. They would meet the God who's promised to be there, to sustain and to give grace. And even if we leave this place with more questions or with our questions not answered, please don't let us leave this place without having met with you, to having met the Comforter, the one who carries us through the midst of greatest grief. We ask this in your wonderful name. Amen.
Right, we're just going to do some quick Q&A. There's been quite a few coming through, and I've just tried to lump them into buckets. So you might not have the exact question, but it'll have the same theme. And if you feel we haven't justifiably answered some of your questions, what we'll do is during the week, we can answer everything on email in a longer way, and we can send you some stuff. All right, so the first one is around someone who's had a friend that recently lost a family member. And it says, "I have a friend that lost her father, and she blames God for what has happened to her. How do I help her?"
Look, I mean, that's a tough one. I would say as a start in that, just be there. There's something about being present with people who are suffering that says a lot more. You know, people are not interested. They may have whys, but they don't actually want to know the why. When they say, why did this happen? It's not actually a question. It's a statement. You know, they're venting. They don't want to have you sit down and give them a theological treatise and take them to Romans 8:28, in all things God works for the good, you know. And they're like, you're a moron. Like, get away from me. That can come maybe down the line. But if you're, especially if you're a Christian, I would say just go and be with a person. Don't phone them. Don't Facebook them. Don't tweet them. You know, I'm here for you kind of rubbish. If it's within your physical ability to be with the person, get in your car, whatever, and get alongside them and just be with people who are suffering. That would be my number one start in the early days. And then, you know, as they go through the grieving process, you do want to help them build a theology of suffering. Understand a God who is loving and good, who does work all things. Help them to see purpose in it. But just go very slowly with people. I mean, grief is real. Eh? Yeah, I don't want to dump your best philosophical argument on people, especially if they're your friends or family. I mean, this girl's dad's died. That is brutal, you know. Go slowly on the answers and go big on presence.
Yeah, maybe I'll just summarize that then. So one, be there for them, what Doug is saying. Initial stage is don't preach to people, just love and care for them. I think then the second step, as time grows, as time passes, you need to help people, as Doug said, develop a good biblical theology of suffering. Help people develop the right perspective of God and what He promises. So in Scripture it says you will suffer. So if people believe that God doesn't want us to suffer, it poses a lot of problems for them when they do suffer. So I think second step over time is help people understand who God is and His view of suffering. So He does promise suffering, but then at the same time He says, I've overcome. So the good that come out of suffering and the resource that we have in God to overcome suffering and His purposes. And then thirdly, what Doug didn't say is, so I would say be there with people, help them develop the right biblical theology. And then thirdly, I think you always need to get to the person of Jesus and the cross. Because in the cross, in the picture of the cross, you can never look at a God and say that He doesn't care. Because He died. He puts Himself in personal human suffering for us so that we don't have to ultimately ever suffer again for eternity. So in the journey is caring for people, helping them develop the right perspective, but you ultimately want to get them to the cross where they can see the goodness of God in Jesus, the one who actually suffers more than any of us. And then fourthly, there's always good resources that you can share with people down the line of other people, books and that they've written. Okay, let me see what we've got here. You've put some interesting arguments about evil and suffering, some good philosophical, logical points that prove that God and evil could exist together. But my problem is I'm still angry. So the philosophy doesn't help me. It seems to me in some way we're often trying to get the Christian God off the hook for what's happening in the world.
Yeah. That's also a good question. That's whatever anyone says when they're trying to think of the answer. They say, no, that was a good question. I think I would agree with you. I would agree with you. If Jesus hadn't come into the world, I think we'd be more in agreement. But I think God is, I think it's Don Carson who talks about this. He says, God has put Himself on the hook. You know, He hasn't tried to get Himself off the hook with clever theological, philosophical arguments and proofs and stuff. Like, God came into the world to suffer in our place, with us, for us. So it's not just a God who's abstract and He's just like, well, you know, here it is. Like, yeah, there's my best argument. Like, if Jesus hadn't come, it'd be a different story. But He has come. And so I don't see a God who's trying to get Himself off the hook. Carson says He's put Himself on the hook. He's got into suffering there. So I think, you need to get to Jesus as quickly as possible. The philosophical stuff always has an end. There's always an end to how satisfying those answers will be and how much clarity they'll bring for you. You need to consider the person of Jesus and how God has treated suffering and how God Himself has suffered, because it changes your view and your picture of what that God is like.
Yeah, I think that's right. So we have a God who puts Himself on the hook. We don't have a God who's trying to get off the hook. And again, we get to Jesus and he dies. And I think in that there's great encouragement and there's great hope and there's great relief. Because if we didn't have a God who put himself on the hook, we have no hope of a future. That means evil and suffering will be with us forever. But the fact that God puts himself on the hook to solve the problem that in eternity future, we will live without any evil or suffering ever again. So thank goodness we have a Christian God who actually comes to us and cares, not an abstract God who just leaves us to our own devices. We have a God who puts himself on the hook and doesn't avoid the issue. Why doesn't God... Why doesn't God just eliminate all evil and suffering? You know, why can't he make us, mature us, refine us without suffering? Why does he need suffering? Why doesn't he just remove it in the first place? If he's sovereign and good, he can just make us mature. So why doesn't he just remove evil and suffering?
That's a good question. I mean, if you're asking that question, you need to also then consider the thing of he needs to then eliminate you. I mean, have you not contributed in any way to your own suffering or to the suffering of others? And hands up if that's you, because then you don't get eliminated. You know, we have all to some degree, less or greater, contributed to the collective suffering. So asking God, get rid of all the evil and suffering and horrible people, it's like, okay, good, you know. He did that almost once. Well, not you believe that, but I don't think it's a possible thing because we are so intrinsically linked to suffering. I think it's rather take a better view of how God will deal with it one day. He will eradicate evil and suffering and make everything right. But yeah, we're part and parcel of it, so asking him to get rid of it. What is the question? Like, get rid of all evil and suffering?
Yeah, why does he need to use it? Why is it here? Can I add one thing then?
Yeah.
I think it's a great point. If God eliminates evil and suffering, he has to eliminate me because I'm sinful and I contribute to the evil and suffering in the world. So he has to wipe us all out. The other one is everybody holds on to this value of free will. We all believe in the fact that we have free will. So if we want a perfect world, that's a perfect loving world, we have to have free will. So if I say to you, I love you, for that statement to have meaning, it must have been freely exercised. That no one forced me, I'm not a robot, that I actually mean it because I voluntarily made that choice to love you. But the problem with having free will is you open the door to having free will to make evil choices. So you can't have it both ways. So if you want a perfect world where there's no evil, you have to have free will. And free will opens the door to a two-way road where you have free will to make good choices, but at the same time, you've got free will to make evil choices. And that's why God can't remove evil, I think, in some senses.
I think also that none of us actually want God to turn a blind eye towards evil. You know, the wrong that's been done to you, you want somebody to pay for it. God says, you know, he'll deal with it kind of thing. And it's inbuilt into us a desire for justice that God will exercise in the way that he feels is sovereign and right and in his time. But, you know, God would be unjust if he didn't punish evil. You know, if he didn't hold us to account for the evil that we do. And that's the whole story of Jesus. That God then steps into our shoes and takes the punishment that's supposed to come to us. But you know, what kind of a God would there be? How just would he be if he would just allow all these baby rapes to just go on and be like, oh, well, no one's going to pay for any of this kind of stuff. It's fine. It's not such a big deal. He wouldn't be holy. He wouldn't be just. He'd be a tyrant. He'd be evil. So it doesn't really hold.
Okay. You know. We're talking about the sovereignty of God, that God's in control. But we have suffering in the world. I don't see how this can be reassuring or provide me with any safety or hope or peace because it means potentially that God is behind my suffering. So if I have a sovereign God over suffering, it doesn't give me with peace. How can that be?
Yeah. Look, I mean, all you have to do is examine the Christian narrative and worldview, and hopefully we've done some of that to some helpful degree today. But consider your alternatives. Your alternatives are that God is not sovereign, that you've got to go with another belief system, that suffering is by chance. So when you suffer, it's got some root somewhere, we don't know, it's just random. You know, I prefer to hold to the Christian worldview that God is ultimately behind all suffering. Because if he allowed it, he can end it. If he didn't allow it, he has no ability to end it. Because he's not actually sovereign, he's not in control. I prefer a God who is sovereign and who has reasons that I don't understand in my finite understanding of why things are happening. I prefer that, even though it raises difficult questions, to like the universe is just out of control. Sorry for you, you know, if you get whacked by cancer and stuff, you know, my stepdad's cancer has returned. We found out yesterday, you know, and my mom is just absolutely gutted. But yeah, as I was talking through it with her on the phone, you know, the hope and the counsel that we can give to people is God allows us. God knows what's going on. This is not just karma. Karma is awful. There's no hope in it. I'd rather cling to a God who, though I can't see and understand, I just know that He, in an ultimate sense, is behind it and has allowed it for His good purposes. It's far more reassuring than just being hit by this haphazard suffering and evil. I think the one gives much more hope than the other.
Yeah, I would just add that if God is not sovereign, then there's no hope. We have no assurance that what's happened to you can't be changed and it'll always exist. One of the great fundamental beliefs of Christianity is that God will make all things right. On the cross, He's died for Satan, sin, and death to make all things right. We live in the in-between time, but ultimately when He returns, everything will be made right. So if God is not sovereign over everything, we have no hope that He will make everything right. If it's just some random occurrence outside the sovereign hand of God, you have no recourse. And it's very despairing. So for me, the alternative is worse than having a sovereign God that allows suffering to occur and that He helps us in it.
How many more are there?
There's two short ones. Okay. Okay, we can answer these two, we're done. I don't want closeness with God and His comfort, I want answers.
I mean, I think I sort of touched on that a little bit. And I mean, I understand that. It's natural to want answers. But I would still maintain that there's a limit to the amount that answers will satisfy.
Yeah.
You don't need the why, you need the who. I think I said, you need Jesus in the midst of suffering, not crystal clarity, because you might not like the answers you get. You know, God, give me answers. He gives you the answers. You're like, whoa. Well, that's not very reassuring. You know, answers are not reassuring. He is reassuring. He is the comforter. What was that about trying again? Oh, that's all I heard was try again. Let me start from the beginning there.
That's God giving an answer.
Yeah.
Trying to communicate.
Just Google the answers. Okay, let's go with the last one.
Okay, I'm not suffering at the moment, but how do I keep calm or at peace knowing that in light of what you said, I potentially may suffer in the future? How do I prepare? How do I deal with that?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. We have an absolute aversion to suffering. Inbuilt into the human being is an absolute aversion to suffering. So you need to bed that one down that you will suffer. Okay, get over it. Take that fear of suffering to God and say, I trust you. Whatever you choose to bring my way, I know that you are a good dad and it's not that you won't give me more than I can handle, but I'm in your hands and they're big and good and strong hands. This is good for me. Whatever will come. You may suffer in different ways, different people, you know, all that kind of stuff. But you've got to trust in the nature and the character of God and bed down the truth that you more than likely will suffer in some way. Because once you've got that down, when it comes, because I think the Bible makes a case that you will suffer at some point, not that you may suffer, that you will. So if you know you're going to suffer, you're taken less by surprise. You know, you're just like, well, this is part of the Christian life. It's come in. And to prepare in advance for suffering. So I would say you need a good theology of suffering that prepares you before the time of suffering comes. And you understand who is God, what are the resources for suffering. He's with you in the midst of it. His purposes in it, all that kind of stuff, that you're in a community of people who can suffer with you, that's a big one, because somehow we feel like when you suffer, you need to suffer alone, which is just bizarre. And part of the Christian worldview and narrative is that when we suffer together. Get in a group of people that can weep with you and carry you when you have nothing in you. I would also say that you get your head around some verses in the Bible that talk about casting anxiety onto God. I think I have developed more anxiety problems in more recent years of my life than I ever used to battle with. And so that scripture has been very real for me. That cast all your cares on him. Why? Because he cares for me. I can give God my cares and anxieties because he cares for me. There's such truth and power in that. And if you're crippled with anxiety about what may come, you're trying to control your own world. And you'd make a very bad God. You'd make a very bad God. Think if you allowed everything to happen in your life that you thought was a great idea, your life would probably be a train wreck. God's plan for you is infinitely better than your best laid plans for yourself. So you've got to hold on to that God, you're a sovereign, good dad, your plans are the best, and I'm going to give you all my anxiety so that you can give me all of your peace. And that is just like a cyclical thing. For some of us, it's a daily process. Others battle less with it. But give God your anxiety and try not to control your own life because he has good things for you. Again, it's a theology. Like if you think God's out to get you, you're going to be terrified of what may come down the line. Terrified because God's just looking to whack you and bring cancer into your life because you deserve it or something. But you don't find that anywhere in here, that the character and the nature of God is like that. You find a loving, good, sovereign dad. Yeah. All right, let me pray. If you're new, visiting here, whatever, we normally sing after I preach, because we find that that's a way for us to respond. Like we hear from God's word, then we respond to him. Today we're going to be sharing in communion. So we're going to sing a couple songs, sharing communion. If you're a Christian, I'd encourage you to share in communion with us. When it comes around, it's going to be passed around the place. So just so we are, eat and drink when you're ready. And Mick and the team will lead us. Let me pray before we sing. Father, thank you for your grace on us. We now, as we prepare to respond to you, we thank you that you're a God who invites our questions, and that throughout the scriptures we see your people voicing their anger, their grief, their lament, their confusion to you. And engaging with you, and we're so grateful, God, that you don't turn people away who are angry with you, who are shaking their fist at heaven, who are confused and bewildered in the midst of suffering, but that you invite our pain, you invite our questions. You know how we're made, you know what we're struggling with, and right now I want to pray that you would help us to be honest with you. To be honest with you about our picture of you, who we think you are, what we think you're doing, to just bring ourselves, not to tidy ourselves up before we come to you, but just to bring all of our struggles, our hurts, our suffering. We pray particularly this morning, Father, for people who are in the midst of suffering at the moment. Those who are suffering financially, those suffering with their health, those just weighed down with depression and anxiety and fear, guilt-ridden. Those who are suffering relationally. Think of people wanting to have children who are suffering and just in great grief around that. Those whose children are rebellious. Those who are battling at work. Those who have lost work. Father, I thank you that we don't have to list them all, but you know the individual ways in which we're suffering. We thank you that we can hold on to you and know that when we suffer, God is near. And pray that this morning that would be our experience, that we wouldn't just talk about these things in philosophical and theoretical ways, but that we would meet with the God who's near to us. We need comfort, we need help, we need hope, we need Jesus. We thank you that you are faithful to come to us in the midst of our greatest suffering. We want to worship you now in the midst of some of these questions and say that you are good and you're worthy of our worship. You're worthy of our praise, even in the midst of our confusion. We love you. You've revealed enough of yourself to us to make you worthy of all of our love and our adoration. And so we come to worship you this morning.